This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Feldberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly. And on tonight's show, we've got stories of speed in engineering and the slowest form of strip transportation. In the second half of tonight's program, Weekly staff writer and auto aficionado Aaron Ryan joins me to talk about the Imperial Palace auto collections. But first up, staff writer Rick Lax talks about the strip less seen.
Thank you, Sarah. Yes, this week I got a story coming out about the businesses on the Strip, only not on Wynn, Bellagio, the big businesses. This story is about the one-off businesses, the mom-and-pop food shacks and the one-off tattoo parlors. And I walked the whole Strip. I got some stories from them. And today I'm going to be interviewing fellow Las Vegas journalist Matthew O'Brien. Now, he's right now working on a similar piece, only his piece is not about the businesses between Mandalay and Stratosphere. He's been stopping at the businesses on Las Vegas Boulevard between Fremont Street and Sahara. So he's working on this for a book that's going to be put out in accordance with the Vegas Valley Book Festival. Comes out in a couple of months, but we're going to get a preview today on what he's learning about. So, Matt, how is business between Fremont and Sahara?
Well, let's just say it's been in recession much longer than 3 or 4 years, that stretch, more like 40 or 50 years. It did actually have a peak, you know, when a lot of the homes and neighborhoods were downtown. This stretch of the boulevard was pretty active with mom-and-pop stores, grocery stores, liquor stores, barber shops. But as people fled to the suburbs, this stretch went into decline, and it's just now trying to come back up.
So what years was it most active, and what years did this decline take place?
From what I could tell, it looks like the 50s and 60s. It was pretty active, a lot going on that stretch. There were drive-in restaurants there, a lot of car dealerships, wedding chapels, of course, date back to the late 30s on that stretch. And when our city started sprawling in the 70s and 80s and people started either kind of dying down there, a lot of the older residents are moving out to the suburbs, that's when the stretch went down. And then more in the 80s and 90s and beyond, you have more of the tattoo parlors, the bail bonds agencies, the pawn shops moving into that stretch, and it's kind of created what we see on there today.
So would you say most of the businesses that you saw personally when you were walking this area, are they newer businesses or are they older businesses that suffered, or are they mostly gone by now?
Well, most of the spaces are older, but unlike the Strip where you may have one or two buildings that have been on one location, here you'll have one building that's probably changed ownership and shop titles, you know, maybe 10, 15 times over the past 40, 50 years. But it's funny because it sounds like my piece is kind of a companion piece to your story where you started at the south end of the Strip and walked to the north end near the Sahara. I picked up at Sahara and walked down to Fremont from there. I've always found that stretch of road to be one of the more interesting stretches of road in the valley because it's a bridge between the Strip and Fremont Street, but locals and tourists rarely take time to stop along this stretch and kind of see what's there, and that's part of what I was trying to do with this story.
So what could this area do to get locals to stop by more? Is there anything they can do? Or is it more the locals' fault for never paying attention in this area in the middle?
Well, this stretch is trying to come back up along with the rest of downtown, with Fremont East and the Arts District, and it is making some progress. One of the more interesting things I think about this stretch is that over the years, so many business owners, Bob Stupak comes to mind, and politicians, Goodman, and others have tried to do whatever they can to bring this stretch back, and nothing's really worked until they decided to film a reality show at a pawn shop along this stretch, and that pawn shop is now getting 4,000 to 5,000 visitors a day, and I live right next door to the pawn shop at Gas in the Boulevard, so I know, I just can't believe the foot traffic that is starting to come along this stretch to go to the pawn shop, and that's helping revitalize the three or four surrounding blocks.
So everyone knows about this, the pawn shop now, but what's maybe one business that you think is also very interesting that might even warrant its own reality show that our listeners maybe have not heard of?
Hell, I can think really of about 20 to 25 businesses on that stretch that deserve their own reality show. Because you go into
right,
a
Sarah,
wedding.
How much time we got in this interview, Sarah?
You know, probably not enough for 25 reality
right,
show
so
pitches.
Let's cut it to three reality show pitches. Top
well,
three.
No. For instance, you go into a wedding chapel and it dates back to the 1930s. A family used to live in this home. And then the husband was a minister who did weddings illegally. And then finally he got licensed. It became an official wedding chapel.
Now, why would
and it's
you
been
to,
passed down to family to family.
Why would a wedding be illegal if he was a minister? What makes it illegal?
He just wasn't licensed at one point.
Okay.
There's a wedding chapel kind of north on that stretch near where the courthouse used to be. And when people would get their marriage license, they would just say, well, you know, Mr. Smith over there is a minister. He can do it for you. And they would just knock on his door, basically, and he would perform the ceremony there before he was licensed as a wedding chapel.
All right, we got two more pitches to go. Another business in this area on Las Vegas Boulevard between Fremont and Sahara. It's really interesting that not nearly as famous as the pawn shop.
Well, I would say Showgirl Video.
What is Showgirl
You can
video?
Act like you don't what know what that
I'm
is, right?
I'm not familiar.
And that's fine.
So it has to do with
Showgirl. Your stuff.
So it has to do with Showgirls, right? It's a Showgirl. It's a porn store.
Yeah, it is, which one thing that I really kind of surprised me a little bit, you know, on this walk is just it's easy to generalize and stereotype stores as you drive by them. But when you actually go into them and start talking to people, customers, or clerks, you get this whole different impression. Like I was always a little bit creeped out by Showgirl Video. Then I go in and there's this guy named Michael behind the counter who has a college degree from a liberal arts school in the Northeast and he's working on a novel. And this really kind of smart, articulate guy who's worked there 10 years and he shared all their stories.
Do we know what his novel's about? Did he pitch it? He must have pitched it to you. You're a big time author. He wants to impress you. So
No. I was mainly just asking him about the customers and the merchandise and some of the weird stories, you know, from the place. And
what was a weird story that might have took place?
Well,
at
one,
Showgirl
he
Video?
He mentioned the guy who worked the graveyard shift was working, and a drunk guy came stumbling in, and he looked at the counter and said, "Can I buy that?" And he was pointing to some lube, warm kind of lube lotion type thing. And so he bought it, and he took the cap off and chugged it right there in front of this clerk, wiped his mouth, put the cap back on, like threw it in the trash can right there and walked out. And that was the last I had heard of this guy.
All right, that's pretty awesome.
But I think we can safely assume that's probably not the dumbest thing that's been done or the craziest thing that's been done on this stretch. Remember Britney Spears
got married. Sarah, did you see where that story was going?
You know what? I did not see the lube chugging coming a mile away, I have to say.
No, I thought it was going to be a sexual act, but surprisingly wholesome in the end.
No, he was just thirsty.
He was, and it was close by.
And I was saying Britney Spears also got married at one of the wedding chapels along that stretch. I think it's called the Little White Wedding Chapel.
How long did that marriage last?
About 48 hours, I think, before it was annulled.
To the great Jason Alexander. But not Jason Alexander.
Right.
All right. And your third pitch, we've got two pitches. What's one more business between Fremont and Sahara where you've seen some interesting stuff there?
Well, this wouldn't probably be a good fit for a reality show, but one of the interesting spaces I kind of discovered there, I knew about it briefly, but I went in and kind of talked to more people there, is Studio 810. It's on Las Vegas Boulevard north of Charleston, and it is an art studio, and all the art is produced by mentally and physically disabled people. And they have an art studio there where they make all the work, and then they have a gift shop where they sell all of it, and they work there as employees too. And really good quality cards and stationery and some artwork as well, paintings and sculptures and stuff like that.
Do you know going into it that all the art comes from mentally and physically challenged people? Does it say that on the front door, for instance, or is that something you only find out by asking, something that's not that apparent?
Yeah, no, it's not advertised, you know, on a sign or as you walk in, but you can also see the studio just off the gift shop. It's a big open studio, and you can see kind of people in wheelchairs working there and the people doing their work. So it's kind of one big open space.
Well, it sounds like you didn't just visit the businesses in this area. You also talked with some of the people. Did the people between Fremont and Sahara on Las Vegas Boulevard, did they have thoughts about Fremont or about the Strip? Like, we might have perceptions about the area that you traveled in, which is, like you said, it's a lot of bail bonds places and low-end strip clubs. But what did they say about Fremont or about Las Vegas Boulevard?
Well, yeah, about the Strip, they will say, of course, that it's big and corporate and overly expensive. Here along our stretch, it's more real, it's more affordable, there's a little more character, and in some cases, history. And I think that's true. That stretch, obviously, is a little more comparable to Fremont. The two are directly related. When Fremont Street, you know, was a dirt road in the 1910s and even in the 1920s, growth finally started down what was then Fifth Street. It became Las Vegas Boulevard towards the Strip, but obviously it kind of stopped around Charleston, did that leapfrog, you know, in the 30s and 40s from Fremont Street all the way down to what is now the Strip, but what was then out of town. And this kind of section kind of got forgotten, and it really has never filled back in all the way.
So it hasn't filled back in all the way, but presumably some people are still going there. And this might be our last question, but what type of person is it who hangs out or spends time at this area of Las Vegas Boulevard?
Well, I said if there's a homeless Elvis, and I think there is, he probably hustles and sleeps along this stretch. So you'll see everything from like homeless people to reality TV stars, you know, to attorneys. There's a dry cleaner at Gas in Las Vegas Boulevard that's been there since the 40s. They think it was kind of an illegal gambling den that was turned into a dry cleaner and run by the mob, and it's been there forever. And you'll see these really nice shiny cars pull up in the morning, and these kind of older men going in with their clothes. They're judges, attorneys, people like that who frequent this stretch as well. But what about your story? It seems like we've talked an awful lot about mine. I'm kind of curious about what you found on the Strip.
Yeah, I found that there were not as many one-off businesses as I thought. In my head, the whole Strip was populated with really small shops stuck in between the casinos. But when I actually walked it, I found this is not the case. I mean, there's definitely a dozen or two dozen one-off businesses, but not that many more than two dozen. So that's the big thing I found, that the big casinos really have taken up almost all the space on Las Vegas Boulevard.
Yeah, I think that's the difference between the Strip and the stretch of the boulevard that I explored, is that the small shops are still on the stretch of the boulevard that I explored. And on the Strip, they've all been kind of demolished, and bigger, supposedly better things have been kind of built in their place.
Yeah. Well, if you want to read more about these small properties on the Strip between Mandalay and the Stratosphere, that's my story that's coming out in this week's Las Vegas Weekly, and you can pick it up for the next week. Or if you would like to hear more from Matthew O'Brien, his story on the businesses between Sahara and Fremont, that's going to be coming out during the Las Vegas Valley Book Festival. Or if you want to read some of Matt O'Brien's work right now, you can head to Amazon or to the local bookstore, and you can pick up the book My Week at the Blue Angel and Other Stories from the Storm Drains, Strip Clubs, and Trailer Parks of Las Vegas. Now, that book has some photos from Bill Hughes also. You could read it right now, or you can visit Matt at www.beneaththeneon.com. Matt, thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you. Look forward to reading both your stories, the one that's going to be in the Vegas Valley Book Festival collection that I'm contributing to, and the one in the weekly this week.
Well, thank you, sir. Now let's turn it back over to Sarah.
Welcome back to Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Felberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly, and joining me now is staff writer Aaron Ryan, who spent some time at the Imperial Palace Auto Collections last week and is here to tell us a little bit about the vehicles and the people who keep them running. Thanks so much for joining me, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get started, you know, the story that you wrote, really, really interesting to me. I know nothing about cars, maybe as evidenced by the really banged up Toyota Corolla that you had to follow on the way here tonight. I apologize for that. But I wanted to hear a little bit about your own history with cars.
Well, when you called me an aficionado, I was really appreciative of that. But I would say that it's more accurate that I'm sort of an amateur admirer working on maybe someday becoming an aficionado, because I, too, know very little about the mechanics of cars, which are so
sure.
important. But I've loved cars and ridden in some amazing cars growing up. And the first car that I ever drove was actually the family station wagon. And it was a 1982 Chevy Malibu Classic with faux wood paneling, whole nine. And I have to say that of all the cars I've ever driven, it was the smoothest ride.
Really?
And I mean, you could buy that car for probably $500 today. But it really, I once hit a curb in it and it didn't have a scratch on it. I mean,
wow.
It was sort of like a tank, but it drove like a Cadillac.
That's a good car to learn how to drive on.
Yeah. And the car that I wasn't allowed to learn to drive on was my dad's baby. He's had it since, I think, 1968. It's a 64 Corvette Stingray, gunmetal blue. And even though the 65 is more popular with a split window, this car, it looks like butter. I mean, it's the most beautiful car. And he drives it a lot in the summer.
Really?
He's one of those, you know, people that has a really sweet classic car that actually gets it out on the road, which I think, you know, that's sort of the community that I prefer, even though there are some amazing collectors who have, you know, warehouses full of gorgeous stuff that they just look at and polish.
Sure.
And so as I've grown and become a little bit more mature, my dad has let me drive it a few times. And it is aerobic. It is like, I mean, you need to wear sensible shoes. You need to have buff arms, and you really have to pay attention to the car. And I think for me, that's one of the biggest differences between older cars and newer cars, is that modern technology and conveniences have made it so we don't really have to think about anything.
We don't
driving.
Really even have to parallel park anymore. There's the beepers that are going off that tell you when you're getting too close.
Exactly.
The takes self-driving all the challenge, car. The self-driving car that Google's proposing takes all the challenge out of driving.
It does. Well, and it really takes the soul out of driving and the fun out of driving. I mean, people used to go on Sunday drives for fun. Like, they would get in the car and drive for hours because they wanted to, because it was a really cool experience to be in the car and see the scenery. And nowadays, you know, especially in Las Vegas in the summer, you wouldn't really want to do that, especially without AC, you know, in something from 1935. But in that car, the feel of the engine is probably the biggest sort of sensory assault. And it's a wonderful assault. It feels like you're inside of it because it's so low to the ground. It's so big and loud, and there's nothing really muffling it from you. And shifting, I mean, I don't know how many times I tried to go into third and I went into first. It was a total disaster, but I'm excited to drive that car again, because you just, wherever you go, however fast you're going, you feel like you're on a racetrack. It's
it
awesome.
Sounds like an experience.
It is.
Does your dad have a name for it?
You know, he's not the kind of guy that names stuff, but I may one day name it something like Blue Seal.
I like it. So you went down to the Imperial Palace. What made you so interested in the collection there?
I had actually visited the collections probably about a year ago, and it was just one of those things. My boyfriend and I were here. It was a nice day, and we wanted to go do something. And I knew about it, and I was like, why don't we go check this out? He actually knows a lot about cars. And we were in there for 4 hours, I want to say, which isn't even enough. I mean, you get in there, and it's like 150 cars worth of gorgeous, amazing everything, from the bodies to what's under the hoods, which a lot of the time, you know, if you're not with someone who works there, you're not going to be able to go and like pop the hood. But some of the cars have the hoods open so you can look at the mechanics and the hubcaps and the special little things, like an electronic martini mixer in one and like a magnetized cup holder in another one, and just, you know, special things that were luxury items back in the day that you can't even get now.
Well, an electronic martini mixer, I would think, would be frowned on in a modern car. Kind of like a DUI risk. Maybe an electronic latte maker we could get into a modern vehicle.
That would be probably equally as dangerous. But that car actually is no longer there. But that was one that was in the collection before. And that's the cool thing about this collection is it's always changing. It's not just a car museum, it's a car dealership.
And they actually are still selling pieces on a regular basis, is that right?
Oh yeah, I mean, they said that when the economy was good, they were moving a car a day.
Wow.
And they have about 500 cars at any given time in their collections, and they display about 150, and it changes all the time. I mean, my favorite car from a year ago isn't there anymore.
What was that?
You know, it was a Ferrari touring car from the 60s. I can't remember the exact name. It was just the coolest, most unique, weirdest color blue I've ever seen. It had leather straps on it. I mean, it was just like a car you would never see anywhere, like a one of a kind. So yeah, I think that, you know, if you love cars, even if you've seen this collection a dozen times, you could see it a dozen more times and it will always be fresh and exciting, and especially if you're a real car lover. But you don't have to be to appreciate it, because I mean, you walk in there and it's like liquid, you know, smoldering, like liquid hot magma paint. Like the paint on all these cars looks wet because it's so shiny and so perfect.
Sounds
and everything
beautiful.
Is like just like a piece of art. I think that people don't think about cars that way. But there's a lot of stuff, and it's not just the old stuff. They have some race cars that won huge races and have a lot of history, and the buyers for those don't want them altered at all.
Sure.
They don't even want, you know, the oil changed or the engine tuned up. They want it exactly in the condition it was when it finished the race.
And this is, I mean, the mix of cars, the mix of vehicles you're describing is really interesting. How did this collection come to be?
Well, the original collection at the Imperial Palace started in the very early 80s with Ralph Engelstad, who owned the casino, and it was his own private collection. He decided he wanted to share it with the public, and that was where it started. It got taken over in 99 by two of the greats in the industry, Richie Klein and Don Williams. Together, they have touched probably every amazing car in existence and owned it at some point and sold it. And they aligned their two empires and started their own thing. And they kept the name pretty similar because they wanted people to still identify with the spirit of the idea that Ralph Engelstad had. And so from 99 to today, they've been in charge, and they have the best of the best. I mean, there are other impressive collections in the world, but this one has everything. It has a little bit of every sort of special thing you could have, whether it's, you know, a concept car or a race car or, you know, a Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance winner, just motorcycles. I mean, anything cool and special that has wheels, they've got a little bit of it there.
And they are for sale. Is everything for sale, or are there certain cars that they just say, you know, this one's special, this one's ours, it's not leaving the Imperial Palace?
You know, I'm not sure what they would say to that. I know that the Johnny Carson car that's there, it was sold to the original auto collection in 1994 for $1. That car is not going anywhere ever. I mean, it's just one of those things, it's priceless. The history, you know, the connection to Johnny.
What kind of car is it?
Oh, man. I knew you were going to ask me.
Breaking out the tough questions.
Oh, what is it? It is a Chrysler Royal Sedan in 1939.
Wow.
And the story behind that car is that it belonged to Carson's dad, and he drove it to his high school prom, took his date in the car, and the car ended up being sold. It was owned by several people, and he hunted it down, and he rebought it, and he had it for many years and just wanted it to live forever in this shrine. And so he pretty much donated it, but, you know.
Right. I mean, it just found a home.
It did. And so that car, you know, they're obviously not going to sell. There are about 20 cars worth over $1 million each in the collection. Those, you know, there are people who can afford them. And if they come in, you know, and make an offer, they might get it.
And they come to Vegas, those people. They do come here.
Those
people who can afford to just stop by and buy a $1 million car. They tend to frequent the Strip, although I don't know about how much time they're spending at the Imperial Palace.
Well, Rob Williams, who's the son of Don Williams, he's the general manager. He told me a great story about a guy that recently won big on the blackjack tables at the Imperial Palace. And he brought home, I think, about $50,000. And at 4 a.m. while he was still playing, he had the concierge call the collections and say that he wanted this car, you know, and that he needed for them to hold it. He wanted the contract brought to the table.
So while he was still playing.
While he was still playing. And he ended up buying the car a few hours later, paid cash. And so that sort of like impulsive, very Vegas idea of like winning big and, you know, blowing your money on something cool, like that actually happens. And then you'll get, you know, this elderly woman who just bought a car there today was less than $10,000. And it was something that, you know, I think she always wanted to have. She could finally afford it. And she's driving it home, you know?
Ah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And do you, I know you said your favorite car was no longer there when you went back to visit this time. Do you have a new favorite? Have you fallen in love with something else?
Oh, yeah. The verdict is still out on that. I mean, honestly, it's one of those things where it's so overwhelming. I have been to the Louvre, and it's a similar, I mean, obviously on a different scale, it's a similar problem. You go in there, and there's an embarrassment of riches. There's too much to see. And you have to really spend hours and really look and read, you know, the plaques and find out about the cars because, as Rob says, it's not just the look of the car, it's the history of the car, the components of the car. The more you know, the more hooked you are. I mean, he said once it's in your blood, it's there forever, you know. And he, growing up, even though his dad was the guy, he didn't really get into it until he was a little older. And now he's owned 50 Volkswagens alone in his life. I don't think he still owns 50, but yeah, it's just the more time you spend, I think things that you might not even have thought would be your favorite might be. You know, based on some quirky little detail.
Sure. And there's a mechanic also who works at the auto collections who actually makes sure that these cars are runnable, like they can leave the property and actually be bought and taken out on the road. Tell me a little bit about him.
He is old school. I mean, this guy, he's what you would imagine a mechanic to be, a really great mechanic who loves getting his hands dirty and knows everything about every car. And the reason that he does is that he learned, you know, trial by fire. He was going to be an electrician. He was following his dad's advice, but he had been obsessed with cars since he was a kid. And he dropped out of school and, you know, got in big trouble with his parents, but he was so gifted. He said that he has good hands and a gear head. And so he just sort of innately understands mechanics. And the more he tinkered with cars, the better he was. And his nickname is The Wiz. And the reason is that he can fix anything, anything. I mean, someone once said that he could probably make a tomato run like a car. And so chatting with him, it was cool to think about where the industry, his industry, has come based on technological advancements that, you know, we all really appreciate now, as do the mechanics. You know, we bring in a car, they plug it into a computer, they know immediately what's wrong.
Right, they just pull it up on the screen, print
exactly.
It out, and go.
And they've got machines to help them repair it, and it's a very sort of mechanized process, which is kind of ironic considering the word mechanized. But in the old days, I mean, it was like a sick animal. You had to just check it out and listen to it and feel things and really think about what the problem might be and try something and take this off and put it back on. Bob is that guy, and he loves American cars. I mean, he's worked on English cars, French cars, Italian cars, German cars, pretty much everything you've ever seen. But he's a huge fan of Chrysler and Cadillac and these American brands that, you know, in the wake of the economic crisis, people are not appreciating as much. But their legacies and the histories that they have, the more you know about them, again, there's just so much there to love. So,
well, we are about out of time. But for our last question, if there's one car, you're going to go to the collections, people are going to look around, what's the one car they should just stop and ponder for a moment?
Well, the Duesenbergs are probably the most special. There were fewer than 500 ever made, ever. And the Depression pretty much killed the company in the late 30s, but about almost 400 of them survived because they were so special and people realized that the day they were made. You know, it wasn't one of those things where over the years they got appreciated. They have quite a few there. They're incredibly huge and beautiful, and they all have cool stories. So just ask to see one of the doozies.
All right. See the doozies. Well, you can read more about the Imperial Palace Auto Collections and about some of the fantastic vehicles that are housed there in this week's Las Vegas Weekly. Thank you so much for joining me, Aaron.
Thank you, Sarah.
And thank you to our producer, Steven Zeller, and to Matt O'Brien and Rick Lax, who joined us in the beginning of this show. This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV.